We now turn to another aspect of bioethical issues concerning the beginning of life in the Greco-Roman Empire, and that concerns the terrible practice of what I have termed obstetrical infanticide. This is in number 4.3, but which is often referred to in the literature by the more specific terms of craniotomy or embryotomy, which refer to the opening of the skull of the child to be delivered, or the opening of the chest or abdominal cavities in the case of embryotomy. This is a terrible consequence of one of the most feared complications of pregnancy, both in antiquity and in modern times, although there are remedies for it in the modern era, and that is malpresentation. That is, where the child is not positioned in the normal position for delivery with the head set to come out first, but instead is in the breech position with the buttocks or bottom in the birth canal, or more terribly, with the feet or hands or side in the delivery in the lower portion of the uterus. If this is the case, there was an attempt in antiquity to manually turn the child. Sometimes this would be successful, to turn the child either into the head first or the breech, the bottom first position, the head first position being normal, the breech first position being dangerous, but possible. A breech delivery can be accomplished, although it's much more painful and longer for the mother and carries the risk of complications both for her and for the child, because the birth canal, the passageway, is not properly dilated, is not properly opened up to its the size that it needs to be with a breech delivery, as it would be normally with a head-first delivery, the head being the largest part of the newborn child. When it was impossible to turn the child in such a way that delivery could be accomplished, then the terrible dilemma was faced of either waiting for the child to die and then to deliver it in parts, in pieces, or to wait for the mother to die and then to attempt to deliver the child through a cesarean operation, literally through an incision through the abdomen and then through the uterus to remove the child. A cesarean operation in the ancient world always killed the mother. To attempt to remove a child in a malpresentation using instruments in antiquity, that is, forceps of one sort or another, always killed the child. So this terrible event heralded the death of either one or the other. And what one finds then in the medical literature is a description in the Hippocratic texts of the piecemeal removal of a child that has died, and in the text of Soranus, both that and a description of killing the child in order to deliver the child's body in order to save the life of the mother. This terrible obstetrical dilemma, as we shall see, was dealt with specifically in the Talmud, in the Jewish tradition, which had a very different approach to the question of abortion than classical Greco-Roman societies, we shall see. But Christianity did not explicitly begin to deal with this subject until many, many centuries later. So if we drop down below the text, which I invite you to read, which is a recapitulation of what I've just said, number 431 is a picture on the left in particular, a drawing, and in the center and right, pictures of Roman obstetrical instruments, Greek and Roman obstetrical instruments. Again, these were incapable of delivering a child alive. They would only have been used for the piecemeal removal of an infant that could not otherwise be delivered. If you look down at number 432 in a blue bar, obstetrical craniotomy, this is the description in the ancient Hippocratical treatises of the opening up of the infant's head in order to decompress the head and then to be able to remove it, to remove the child. And the presumption in the Hippocratic texts is that this is being done to a child that has died during delivery and could not be otherwise delivered. Now, in Soranus, this medical expert, who, as we mentioned, lived at the end of the first, beginning of the second century AD, in his text on gynecology, there is a description of embryotomy that is, of the, again, piecemeal removal of a child at delivery. And he presumes, as you'll see in number 9.6, that if the fetus does not respond to manual traction, that is, pulling, because of its size or death or impaction in many manner whatsoever, one must proceed to the most forceful methods, those of extraction by hooks and embryotomy, which again means an incision, into the various cavities in order to decompress the chest and the abdomen and the head of the child to be delivered. And so Soranus is presuming that this procedure may be performed on a still living infant, which otherwise could not be delivered. A terrible tragedy, and it is related to the modern practice of partial birth abortion, which is banned in many states and has become, of course, very controversial. Unlike the descriptions in classical antiquity, the partial birth abortion involves the deliberate induction of labor, either during the late second or beginning of the third trimester, and then procedures very similar to these as a form of an abortion, but of course in the modern world, this being done under sterile conditions and with less risk to the mother. So if we drop down now to number 5, under Jewish respect for life, we can see that the Jewish tradition, which Christianity would inherit, had a very different approach to the question of abortion, which according to Soranus, although well regarded with some disdain, was nonetheless permissible, and which certainly would have been widely regarded as permissible in the Greco-Roman world, the Jewish tradition does not permit abortion. And we find in the historian Josephus the description of the fact that direct intentional abortion is forbidden. He says, and this is in number 5.1, the law requires us to bring up all our offspring and forbids women to cause abortion of what is begotten or to destroy it afterward. So in this Jewish tradition of the first century AD, it's very clear that both abortion and abandonment of a child, exposure of a child, or frank infanticide are forbidden in Jewish tradition. And if any woman appears to have done so, she will be a murderer of a child, for by destroying a living creature, she has diminished the human race. Now, we now need to consider the fact that early abortion, although not regarded as encouraged in any sense in ancient Judaism, was at least in the couple of hundred years before the time of Jesus and then into the time of Josephus, regarded as a lesser offense, and it was not considered to be the same thing as homicide. This is because of a mistranslation, which may have been, scholars speculate, a deliberate mistranslation of Exodus 21. This is the text in Exodus that considers the question of an injury done to a pregnant woman and the injury then causes her to have a miscarriage. The Hebrew text is very clear in number 22 and number 23. The Hebrew text is that if two men fight and strike a woman who is carrying a child and she miscarries but suffers no further injury, that's the blue text, that's the original Hebrew, then there is a penalty associated, whatever the woman's husband may impose upon them. But in the Hebrew it says, where injury ensues, that is to say, where the woman is injured in addition to having a miscarriage, he must give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, etc. Now, in the translation of this Hebrew text into Greek, the Septuagint translation, which became the version that was known within Christianity, it was the standard text used for really for the rest of Christianity in the Eastern Christian churches, and was the norm until in the West until the availability of Jerome's Latin Vulgate. The Septuagint translation has a very different approach. In the Septuagint, and you've got a discussion of this by Professor DeMarco, who goes into this in a little more detail, the Hebrew word for form is erroneously used for the word which actually occurs, which means to harm or to cause injury. And the result of this is that in this Greek version, which would have been used throughout the non- Aramaic and Hebrew using world of Jewish antiquity, that is to say, the diaspora tradition of Judaism, the Hellenistic Jewish tradition, what they would have read in their sacred scriptures in Greek would be, if there is a fight and the child is born, that is to say, the miscarriage occurs, but the child is imperfectly formed. Then there is a penalty, and then a number 23, but if it is perfectly formed, then there is eye for eye, tooth for tooth, etc. This means that the Greek-speaking Jewish tradition was accepting something like Aristotle's distinction between early and later embryonic development. That there was a stage, although it's not specified here, there was a period in pregnancy of imperfect formation. That is, the child was not fully formed, was not visibly, did not visibly have all of its human parts. And that the penalty for causing a miscarriage would be less in that circumstance than it would be at a later point in pregnancy when the child would be regarded as fully formed. Note, the question of viability is not used here, the question of whether or not it would be possible for the child to survive. It really was what the state of the fetus appeared to be when the woman miscarried. So this reflects the fact that although abortion is forbidden in Judaism, early miscarriage or being causing an early miscarriage, and thus by association, the induction of an early miscarriage would be a lesser crime than the full-blown murder of the taking of a life of a child at some later stage. And again, exactly when this stage would be would vary, but there does seem to be some influence of Aristotle that there is this 40-day period after which one has more fully human life and before which one does not. Again, as we'll see, early Christianity, especially in the 4th century, will reject this distinction and say that deliberately destroying the child at whatever stage of development is utterly and completely wrong, and that such distinctions will not be observed. We'll see that in the 4th century. But then in the Middle Ages, with the introduction of Aristotle's thought, this kind of reasoning or this kind of thinking will again reappear. And if we drop down to number 5.3, in this circumstance that we discussed at the beginning of this lecture, this the terrible setting in which it is impossible to deliver the child and have the child survive, a text from the Talmud says, if a woman suffers hard labor in childbirth, the child must be cut up in her womb and brought out piecemeal in parts. For her life takes precedence over its life. So there's a statement that the mother's life takes precedence over the child. However, if its greater part has already come forth, that is, if the head has been delivered, you cannot deliberately kill the child. You cannot deliberately engage in this dissection, this piecemeal destruction of the child. It must not be touched, for the claim of one life cannot supersede that of another life. So here there is a suggestion that prior to the delivery of the child's head, the mother's life takes precedence, but after that point, the child's life is equivalent, and neither can be sacrificed for the other. So this represents, again, a reminder that in Judaism, the common acceptance of abortion in the Greco-Roman world is rejected. Judaism rejects abortion. However, in the couple of hundred years before the time of Jesus, the time when the Septuagint would have been known, there is a distinction between what we would today call an early or a later abortion, and there is a lesser penalty for an early abortion, and a later abortion is regarded as the equivalent of homicide.